It's great to come. It's great to come to the drawing center and see someone make a drawing. It's kind of unusual. Great. I'm gonna try that. Is that all right? So thanks for having me, Kagan, Drawing Center. My name's Mark. I'm gonna talk a bit about puppet theater, which is what I work in a lot. I work here with a company called Great Small Works across the river in Dumbo in Brooklyn. And the initial connection to the set of images that Kagan sent was kind of obvious, was this one. But that seemed sort of too easy. It's kind of, we work in hand puppets, I teach courses sometimes in puppet theater. So that was sort of the first, the motion of the hand puppet captured by the camera. I actually began to be drawn to the one just to its left, the acrobat, the gymnast, with a sort of a learned gesture sequence, a choreography captured or chopped into static sequences, a sequence of moves. And that, of course, is another thing one thinks about a lot in performance, and especially some kind of acting. A lot of dancers, obviously, athletes, but also you might not think of it, puppeteers, who actually think of each second and each move and each moment in what they do as a static frame, as you would in a film. So we do a lot of storyboarding sort of in our heads and with our bodies in a kind of live choreography. So that sort of spoke to me about what puppeteers and puppet theater does. And then, now that this doesn't seem like it's working now, is it? We don't even really need it. It's such a small room. But you're recording. And the third was the Nefertiti there on the middle left, your left, which seemed to me like a model being created. On the one hand, a sculptural work, and on the other hand, a kind of model of created by the eye, or tracking a model that tracking the eye's movement as it looks at that image. And the talk I wrote, and I'm afraid I am reading a talk, so it's about 20 minutes, so you can sort of get settled. Is trying to think a little bit about model theaters and how we think about and perform with miniatures, very often on tables, a lot like this sort of tabletop theater, miniature theater, and how that might sync up with how we think of child's play and the relationship between children and adults. So I'm going to certainly digress. It's a very digressive talk. I've been told that on a number of occasions, so I was really happy for the invitation to detour and digress as well. Knock that out. La Petite Géante, the giant girl marionette of the Royal Deluxe troupe from Nantes in France, strides into a park or a street in Guadalajara, Liverpool, or Berlin. Some of you may have seen this. It's on the internet. Royal Deluxe. Suspended from a motorized crane and manipulated by a crowd of red liveried engineers with ropes, guy lines, and pulleys, attendants who seem Lilliputian next to her, she takes a nap, receives a shower from the equally gigantic Sultan's elephant, takes a boat ride, and meets a mysterious undersea diver who emerges from a local river or canal. The pageant of giant puppets and tiny human operators is surrounded by an audience that forms in the street and follows the troupe, their daily routine interrupted. Huge, calm, and silent, despite all the human activity of tending to the puppets, these urban theatrical interventions take 4 or 5 days to perform. The work of Royal Deluxe is manifestly gigantic, dwarfing the surrounding buildings, street lamps, and bridges. It's also miniature. the human performers in antiquated uniforms who operate the machinery, animating the giant marionettes on their stroll through the city, appear the scale of toys. They work as a team of pilots, builders, circus roustabouts, and parade marshals. The girl, elephant, and the diver move slowly, silently, and expressively, the focus of the audience's attention. The puppet's actions are mundane, and yet they completely transform the surrounding street, rendering it as a kind of model, the made-up landscape of an oversized child's imagination. Toys and players have switched positions, an effect, I think, of the model theater, where the gigantic conjures the miniature and vice versa. And if you're interested, I don't have an image of that, but you can Google the Sultan's Elephant, and you'll see that performance. It's a nice video of that. Writing of the artist Sarah Zay's large-scale installations of fantastic landscapes of banal objects, the critic Jeffrey Kastner asks, quote, does Zay's work evoke the grandeur of the immense or the hidden life of the miniature? Does her practice conjure the daydream of the infinite or the infinitesimal? These questions come to mind in response to certain contemporary object-based performances that work, like Zay's installations and Royal Deluxe's performance interventions, with multiple scales, and in particular, with juxtaposed appearances of the miniature and the gigantic. And how might the image of the adult performer playing with puppets, models, or toys, situations in which these multiple scales tend to collide, suggest a new way of thinking about children, adults, and their habits of play? I'm not going to answer all these questions, but I'm going to just throw them out. Performers working with objects and puppets regularly appear across a range of public spaces, political demonstrations, museums, off festival, cabarets, Olympics opening ceremonies, urban interventions, and rural pageantry. Professionalized puppetry is increasingly included in the menu of the serious arts to the extent that the childish, ridiculous, or didactic natures of puppetry are kept in check. Puppetry, for better or worse, is being taken seriously, embodying adult-oriented themes and images moving across the fields of the performing, visual, and projected arts. And as my friend Roman Pasca, who used to live in Soho, puppeteer, has used to say, when you told people you worked as a puppeteer, they would say, do you do shows for kids? And, you know, if you were Roman Pasca, you'd say, no, actually, I don't. And that was, you know, maybe 20 years ago. And now when you say you're a puppeteer, they say, have you seen Being John Malkovich? Or they say, do you know Julie Taymor? Or there's a sort of series of things they say. But they don't say, oh, you do shows for kids. There's sort of there's some shift has occurred that people have other kinds of associations with that particular performance form. So the question of whether puppetry is inherently an art form for children, whether it's perceived as such by the critical and popular press, as well as festival curators, seasoned presenters, persists. The recurring discovery of serious puppetry for adults proclaims that performances using puppets are, amazingly, not exclusively for children anymore, usually under the banner of some kind of headline involving the metaphor of pulling strings. Why, we might ask, does this rediscovery occur? And is it somehow engaged in the reinscription of a normative sense of puppetry as a children's art form, not to mention the reinforcement of a Western bourgeois separation of the world of the child from that of the adult, a separation that Benjamin pondered in his essays on children's toys and play? So I propose three sketchy scenarios here. One in which the critic has genuinely never considered puppets as serious business beyond the realm of entertainment aimed exclusively at children. Two, an instrumental scenario in which the writer has been assigned the adult-oriented show and imagines a public that simply connects puppets, models, and toys with children's entertainment, and then enlightens that imagined naive public with the discovery that, in fact, puppets have a long history of social commentary, taboo speech, and subversive gesture. This rhetoric of discovering serious puppetry for adults seems somehow, by negation, to strengthen and reinforce the notion of puppetry as inherently for children in the first place, which maybe it is. in a third scenario that affirms that despite their serious subject matter or non-linear narrative construction, performances grounded in radical collisions of scale may well belong to the realm of children, and that a post-dramatic puppet theater, instead of reifying the commodified or disempowered subject position of childhood in the space of late capitalism, can, in fact, decisively blur this line by reimagining how we conceive of children, and by extension adults, in the first place, as experts in play with scale. Children, according to Benjamin, form their world of things by themselves, a small world in the large one, full of the most incomparable objects that capture the attention of children who use them, especially garbage and junk left over from building, gardening, housework, sewing, or carpentry, end quote. Roland Barthes calls the child who engages in this world-forming play a demiurge, a creator using objects that can instantly change what they are, rather than merely a user of an overly determined, highly likely plastic toy. The model theater combines this juvenile tendency towards bricolage with the realm of stories that range from the mythic to the banal, from the ridiculous to the documentary, given its powerful ability to show big ideas within the limits of the tiny proscenium frame or the tabletop landscape. And I'll show you some examples of model theater in a second. Benjamin considered the value of revolutionary children's theater, quote, "Everything is turned upside down, and just as master served slave during the Roman Saturnalia, so during the performance, children stand on stage and teach and educate their attentive educators," unquote. Why revolutionary? Children here are conceived as always potential revolutionary subjects, not yet formed by bourgeois civilization, in love with movement, action, and mimetic play, again raising for us the question of what might be at stake when adults build models, play with toy theaters, and animate miniature landscapes. It worked, okay. In a time when the miniature is increasingly associated with technology, and when theater magic is becoming ever more invisible, portable, and cheap, a convergence between the handmade and the technological appears in these two recent productions featuring model theaters. Rimini Protocol, a German company led by a director called Stefan Kagi, one of two co-directors, and the Dutch company Hotel Moderne illustrate two approaches that carefully choreograph a collision of gigantic and miniature architectural scales on stage, and implicitly of typically adult and children's forms of play. Rimini Protocol, a three-member German-Swiss company founded in 2000, has pioneered a, quote, theater of experts. Not exactly site-specific, their work is more personnel-specific, which is to say that it uses non-professional performers who are experts in some field. The director, Stefan Kagi, shapes the community's message into theatrical material using the talents of what he calls specialists of daily life. In the case of Nemo Park, which is this show, the performers were Swiss retirees who love model trains. A professional actress functioned as the MC, kind of directing the performance, introducing and framing each performer's story. An extraordinary portrait of modern-day Switzerland emerges in this show, staged on and around a large working model train layout, complete with miniature mountains, lakes, rural depots, and farmland, organized on rows of waist-high tables around the stage. Mounted on the toy locomotive is a wireless video camera, so the train's eye view appears on a large screen at the back of the stage. As the miniature landscape rushes past, simultaneously tiny and huge, the performers narrate stories of growing up in Switzerland, building a portrait of the nation, of memories and fragments, including personal flashbacks in which each performer, in turn, jumps in front of a green screen backdrop to the side of the stage allowing a second camera's signal to mix their live image into the miniature memory landscapes. Thanks to the magic of the green screen, which affords the possibility of the miniature landscape to become background for human-scale performers in the foreground, one man jumps into an airplane and flies into the sky. This guy. Another rides atop a train car. In these moments of narrative layering, simultaneous stages exist side by side. The blank space of the green screen is total cinematic artifice. The miniature train landscape is tabletop toy theater in three dimensions. They mix in real time thanks to the trick of the video crossfade, merging the performer's rough, task-based choreography with the complex background landscapes rushing past. Other places and times are evoked. As in the classical puppet theater of Bunraku, the presence of the character has been exploded in a division of functions. Music, language, movement, and the expression of emotion have been divided, only to be put back together again before our eyes in the merging of object-based tasks. Here, the technology of the proscenium is enriched by the addition of video cameras, screens, projectors, and live sound score. And these older adults each take their turns animating and being animated inside the model in a visual dramaturgy of constantly shifting scales. An imaginary Switzerland emerges here, a model in both senses of the term, constructed with the clean, lifeless beauty of the static landscapes, complete with snowy mountains, happy cows, green rolling hills, and picturesque villages. The performers, both detached storytellers and giddy time travelers, imply that the Swiss are living in something like a model nation preserved in its pre-war state. A lot of the memories were of sort of before the war and sort of about their experience during the war, World War II. Meanwhile, the pleasure the audience takes in their serious play continues when, after the curtain call at the end of the show, we are invited onto the stage to observe the switches, tracks, bells, and whistles at close range with the artists, railway engineers, tour guides, and new friends. Hotel Moderne is a company of two trained actresses and an architectural model maker, accompanied by a sound designer mixing live and pre-recorded sound effects. Since their founding in Rotterdam, they have evolved a performing style grounded in the animation of models, sometimes accompanied by language, sometimes not. In The Great War, this piece, three silent performers construct scenes from the trenches of World War I, accompanied by recorded stories of soldiers' letters from the battlefield. The stage consists of a series of tabletop sets with small cameras transmitting live to an upstage screen again. Cameras are mounted in and around miniature landscapes, at times positioned on model trains, at times handheld. We hear readings from one soldier's letters and diaries as the camera tracks his unsteady footsteps across ground, first under shelling, then emerging into a destroyed landscape of flame, smoke, and corpses. In a series of shaky, subjective tracking shots, the intimacy is heightened by synchronized live sound effects, shells exploding in the distance, and the soft impact of footsteps on soil in the auditory foreground. As audience, we split our focus from narrative on the screen above to the elaborate situation of live filmmakers working on tables of earth with torches, with torches and air compressors to make fire and shell bursts, not to mention the fragile, small human figures. The object manipulators focus on the complex choreography of objects, cameras, and special effects, simulating warfare in miniature and blowing it up to the gigantic proportions of cinema. The Great War and Nemo Park illustrate how precise and deliberate play with models and resulting fusions of scale resonate with the techniques of children's play. Although neither group describes their work as puppetry, there is a deep connection to the methods, techniques, and attitudes of puppeteers, namely a deliberate combination of small-scale elements, tabletop dramaturgy, and a conscious manipulation of a simultaneous multiplicity of scales. The matrix of camera, live projection, model landscape, and tiny objects renders the miniature world instantly gigantic and positions the performer as both manipulator of toys and manipulated object within an animated stage environment. This may be a theme across our three presentations. The visual rhetoric of live cinema, in which the projected image shifts quickly from close-up to long shot and back, combined with the live choreography of puppet theater, creates, I think, a productive tension suited to the demonstrating of the burdens of history and the careful making and unmaking of the world. Model theater, then, may be considered a genre in uneasy formation here, at the intersection of a tabletop object theater, film animation, the curiosity cabinet, and Brechtian Lehrstück. Questions regarding the experience of the miniature remain to be investigated. What compressed or expanded dynamics of presence are created when performances take place on multiple scales at once? And how might the notion of model theater allow for a more careful consideration of the implication of adults playing with toys? Given the acceptance of the seriousness of the puppetry arts, it seems worthwhile to reconsider the trope of the child's privileged ability to play with toys. The history of toys, at least in their early modern incarnation in the West, is mirrored in the experience of the individual child's growing up. Quote, "A history of the evolution of children's toys can therefore hardly be written," writes Carl Gruber in 1927 in the wistfully titled Children's Toys of Bygone Days. Quote, "Since with each child there begins afresh the same cycle of the play instinct, if we may so call that instinct, to imitate, which forces its way to expression in the heart of every human being," unquote. A curious way to begin a lavishly illustrated history of toys from antiquity to the 19th century, and this book is reviewed by Benjamin in 1928 in one of his little essays. And yet it signals Gerber's insistence that, although toys belong to a history of material culture created by adults for children, the activity of play belongs to the world of children, no matter how detailed or naturalistic, hand or machine-made, the toys become. Quote, "The fantasy of a grown-up, be it ever so winged," he writes, "can never recover the wealth of visions which course past the heart of every child when it is absorbed in its playthings, undisturbed, oblivious of its surroundings," unquote. Funny antiquated language, but this quality of absorption in play belongs, of course, to the puppeteer as well as to the performer visibly animating a toy theater or a model on a tabletop. That focus, that concentration, and that sense of, in a way, being animated as well. In the vocabulary of the model theater, performers are visible, absorbed in their tasks. Their presence is both masked and heightened by the focus required to make the inanimate objects, not to mention the stage itself, expressive, and to conjure a suspension of disbelief, which is, in puppet theater, a belief in the concrete gesture of the puppeteer and its results. If all goes well, the audience believes in the truth of the act and endows the proceedings with a sense of magic and the illusion of illusion. Belief and artifice, truth and faking, reality and magic nervously coexist. The spectator, as Barthes said famously of the art of professional wrestling, quote, "does not wish for the actual suffering of the contestant, he only enjoys the perfection of an iconography," unquote. This gift of one's attention, the willingness to become absorbed, drives global capitalism's fetishization of the miniature gadget, as we do this all the time, and the miniaturization of capitalism's mimetic fetish objects, from sound and video recorders to cameras and projectors reduced to matchbox size. the things that make this kind of work possible nowadays in some ways. The model theater also stages the comparatively ancient, some say primitive, impulse that Benjamin called, quote, the mimetic faculty, that ability particularly strong in children, he says, not only to copy the actions, emotions, and characteristics of adults, but to recognize, quote, non-sensuous correspondences between nature and culture. Quote, the child plays at being not only a shopkeeper or teacher, he writes, but also a windmill and a train, unquote. Benjamin refers to this faculty as a gift for producing similarities and of recognizing them. Furthermore, this gift has become increasingly fragile in proportion to modernity's elimination of, quote, magical correspondences and analogies that were familiar to ancient peoples, unquote. From the mimetic faculty essay that Zoe was referencing as well. The mimetic faculty resides in our language, perhaps the clearest example of those non-sensuous kinds of correspondences that children take for granted when playing with objects, or those specially designed objects that adults call toys. Benjamin noted the particular relationship between toys as a particular category of commodity objects and play as a formative practice for children. For it is not in the toy that play exists, but in the playing, in improvisation and imitation, not in the mimicry of the world of adults, but in the completion of tasks where the toy becomes a necessary accessory. Toys are not commodities, but also they are artifacts that we use to construct the world on a small scale. Nemo Park and the Great War, these two productions, demonstrate a method of calm, intentional, focused remaking of the world from ordinary objects and materials in which dramatic action is produced by the nervous tension between the big screen and the miniature landscape, with the performers mediating between scales. Benjamin wrote a series of meditations on toys and an essay on the politics of children's theater in the years 1928-29, a period in which he published newspaper and magazine articles, short aphoristic thought figures, and gave radio lectures on diverse topics. This was the height of his short-lived career as a public intellectual in Germany. Writing reviews of toy histories and exhibitions in Berlin, as well as specifically on the topic of proletarian children's theater, Benjamin is careful to strategically emphasize the radical otherness of the world of the child. Surrounded by a world of giants, he writes, children use play to create a world appropriate to their size, unquote. Fair enough. But then comes the more cunning insight. Quote, but the adult who finds himself threatened by the real world and can find no escape removes its sting by playing with its image in reduced form. Here Benjamin accounts for the adult's growing interest in children's games and children's books since the end of the war, unquote. He means World War I there. The adult is not simply regressing to childhood, but rather making light of a life grown unbearable. But what is a child anyway? This is the wrap-up. We're getting there. Writing on the figure of the child in the works of Jean-François Lyotard, philosopher Avital Ronel reminds us that the child, quote, constitutes a security risk for the house of philosophy, by which I take her to mean that the child stands in for a defenseless subject, one that has not yet learned to play by the rules of philosophy, law, or reason. She quotes Lyotard asking, quote, what shall we call human in humans, the initial misery of their childhood or their capacity to acquire a second nature, which, thanks to language, makes them fit to share in communal life, adult consciousness, and reason, unquote. The child's performance of mimetic dances, playing with and becoming objects, belongs then to a first nature before language. The adult, absorbed in and by objects and collapsing an everyday sense of worldly scale, recovers some aspect of child's play, mobilizing the muscle memories of childhood, telling stories of war, cultural history, or turning entire city streets into accumulations of building blocks. By childhood, Ronell continues in her reading of Lyotard's analysis, Lyotard means that we are born before being born to ourselves. Quote, we are born from others, but also to others, given over defenseless to them, unquote. A counterintuitive notion of the child emerges, one who is not yet his or her own self, an age that is not marked by age, but rather it does not age, but recurs episodically, even historically. Childhood can last a whole lifetime if you find yourself throttled and unable to root out some representation of what is affecting you. This can happen every day, unquote. That's Ronell writing. No wonder, then, that adults, particularly since the industrialization of modern toy making from the mid-19th century onwards, have taken an interest in the toys of children, particularly in those toys that give children the language and habits of a modern productive life. The bourgeois domestic scene required that children be separated from the chaos of the street, from uncontrollable socialization, and from anything that might, quote, undermine the construction of their children's bourgeois identity. The toy, then, presumes a home, a set of relations, and a regime for the formation of children as future subjects of their nation and class. And the model proposes a means of returning to the past, to retell stories and simultaneously embody them in the present. The model theater, then, occupies an animated landscape created by adults, for adults, in the manner of child's play. Think of the testimonies of great men attesting to the importance of the English toy theater in their boyhoods. Laurence Olivier, Robert Louis Stevenson, G.K. Chesterton, Winston Churchill, Charles Dickens, J.B. Priestley all played melodramas of the amateur toy theater genre as children and as citizens in training of a nation and a class. Their toys, Benjamin writes, cannot bear witness to any autonomous, separate existence, but rather are a silent, signifying dialogue between them and their nation, unquote. The habits of adulthood are tried on for size in child's play, and the serious habits of childhood are embodied by the puppeteer, learning to play again with models and toys at moments of crisis in the world of the adult. Thanks. And now, back to Kate.
Well, we've been here a while, but we can take a few questions if there are any. Does anyone want to ask any of them anything? No? Okay, thanks for coming. The next one, like I mentioned, is on March 12th, and that'll be here at 6:30. Thank you.